Namaste. On the 15th of December, 1916, this essay appeared in the Arya, the great philosophic journal, by then in its third year. The title of this chapter is Kurukshetra, the field of the Kurus. You'll remember that Sri Aurobindo was not a stranger to the antagonism of human life, to the strife, to the warfare that beset it in ages past, in our current age, and so long as the human lives from the level of the mind in the future. Sri Aurobindo was among the first people who proposed driving from India foreign occupation so that India could resume and return to her rightful and necessary leadership of the world by dint of the survival in it of the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal way. Dharma has many dimensions as a term in Sanskrit, and we will at some point have to speak about it extensively. And we will, beyond tonight, have occasion to come back and speak about Kurukshetra extensively. But let's begin with how the Gita begins. Dharmakshetre, Kurukshetre. The question posed by the blind king Dhritarashtra. On the field of Dharma, on the field in which truth is worked out, on the field in which the Kurus have their home, what happened? The chapter, this first of 18, is called Arjuna Vishada Yoga, the yoga of the dejection of Arjuna. And again, to put it simply, this is a great warrior, the greatest warrior of his age, who has come to protect his people, but has to destroy his people to protect his people. And he has come to the point of conflict on this battlefield in India, which still exists. You can visit it. And imagine the many thousands in ages past who confronted each other. Something this pitched, this poignant, occurred. But we can't assign a historical date to it. The date that we traditionally use, 3203 BC, or BCE as they say these days, doesn't match the language that we find in the Gita. The language in the Gita is classical Sanskrit. The language 5,000 years ago would have been the most archaic Sanskrit. We'll not delve deeply into the history, the points of detail, but to note that something rocked the Indian subcontinent. It was a war between families We were part of one family, really. A war that divided a nation. A war that ultimately permitted the deeper truth that India represents to survive and go forward. You'll remember that Sri Aurobindo, when he emerged from the Alipur jail, gave a speech, the Uttarpara speech, in which he noted that it was this living entity which he now served, not simply the liberation of India politically from the British, but something vaster and deeper. The Sanatana Dharma must continue. So he begins this without all of that spelled out. But people who knew him, of course, knew him as the great liberator of India. Still, in those days, India needed to be liberated, but it would eventuate. Sri Aurobindo had been plucked from the political scene by the divine himself and given another mission, perhaps a mission with bigger import. He was assured, Sri Aurobindo, that other people would come and lead, according to the divine will, this great country to its liberation. But there was a different set of challenges meant for him, and he began to work on those. The writing of articles like this formed part of that work. So let's listen to Sri Aurobindo's words. Before we can proceed, following in the large steps of the teacher of the Gita, to watch his tracing of the triune path of man, the path which is that of his will, heart, thought, raising themselves to the highest and into the being of that which is the supreme object of all action, love, and knowledge, we must consider once more the situation from which the Gita arises, but now in its largest bearings as a type of human life and even of all world existence. So Kurukshetra is symbolic of everyone's life. All the challenges that we face at every moment is soul deep. It matters how we assess, how we weigh, how we step into everything that we do. But look what he has done in just this single sentence. But he summarized the Trimarga, the threefold path, raising ourselves through our will, self-dedication, self-offering, through a greatened heart, through a widened thought, to the highest and then into the highest. And who is this highest? Not simply, surely not the ego, not even the universal spirit, but the supreme, the Purushottama, who uses universe and individual as modes of its own self-expression. See it as he or she, that supreme conscious person, has rolled all of this out and is now finding a method by which he can bring the adventuring, journeying soul back home. That's where we come in. So here's the situation. Kurukshetra is world existence. Clash. Difference. This exists in the mind. In the soul, only so far as it's needed. For although Arjuna is himself concerned only with his own situation, his inner struggle, and the law of action he must follow, yet, as we have seen, the particular question he raises, in the manner in which he raises it, does really bring up the whole question of human life and action. What the world is, and why it is, and how possibly it being what it is, life here in the world can be reconciled with life in the spirit. And all this deep and difficult matter the teacher insists on resolving as the very foundation of his command to an action which must proceed from a new poise of being and by the light of a liberating knowledge. So first, Arjuna has to confront the problem, has to see it squarely for what it is. It must be resolved. That's foundational. Then we can outgrow the problem and reach a higher level. A new poise of being, as he says. Live in a liberating light. But what then is it that makes the difficulty for the man who has to take the world as it is and act in it and yet would live within the spiritual life? What is this aspect of existence which appalls his awakened mind and brings about what the title of the first chapter of the Gita calls significantly the yoga of the dejection of Arjuna? The dejection and discouragement felt by the human being when he is forced to face the spectacle of the universe as it really is, with the veil of the ethical illusion, the illusion of self-righteousness torn from his eyes before a higher reconciliation with himself is effected. So again, first, we have to see it. We have to regard it in the round, appreciate it in its fullness and in its details before we can transcend, get to a new level of being, evolve farther. It is that aspect which is figured outwardly in the carnage and massacre of Kurukshetra, and spiritually by the vision of the Lord of all things as time, arising to devour and destroy the creatures whom it has made. Clearly, chapter 11, shloka 32. Time, kala, the time spirit. Ah, all swallowing. Nothing lasts. All is created, preserved, and dissolved. But from nothingness and into nothingness, or from real being, back into real being, for further becoming. This is the vision of the Lord of all existence as the universal creator, but also the universal destroyer, of whom the ancient scripture can say in a ruthless image, the sages and the heroes are his food, and death is the spice of his banquet. That, by the way, is Katha Upanishad 1:2:25. It is one and the same truth, seen first indirectly and obscurely in the facts of life, and then directly and clearly in the soul's vision of that which manifests itself in life. So we see it in the externalities, but we meet it also as an inner, innate truth. The outward aspect is that of world existence and human existence, proceeding by struggle and slaughter. The inward aspect is that of the universal being fulfilling himself in a vast creation and a vast destruction. Life, a battle, and a field of death. This is Kurukshetra. God the Terrible. This is the vision that Arjuna sees on that field of massacre. Of course, the whole of the 11th chapter, you know, deals with this enlarged vision. So, it waits your visit. But also this idea of a divine that is beyond the reckoning of the human mind, that crushes, breaks asunder its systems of ethics. Now, this is the book of Job. This is Chinese philosophy as well. This, for any person who is willing to give a straight look, is obvious. Something is going on here that doesn't fit the human scales of measurement. What is that? War, said Heraclitus, is the father of all things. War is the king of all. And the saying, like most of the apothegms of the Greek thinker, suggests a profound truth. Here's a delicious note. In this issue of the Arya, December 1916, Sri Aurobindo began a series of essays on Heraclitus at the end of the issue. So he took it up, and he noted along the way, as sort of a launching point, some work that R.D. Ranaday had done on Heraclitus. And those of you who are specialists in Indian thought will remember that he did brilliant work in his studies of Veda and Upanishad. Ranaday was one of the real princes of the first part of the 20th century in terms of restoring credibility, I should say, to Indian philosophy. So Heraclitus, an apothegm, by the way, is a pithy saying. It's from the Greek. It means to speak forth. From a clash of material or other forces, everything in this world, if not the world itself, seems to be born. By a struggle of forces, tendencies, principles, beings, it seems to proceed, ever creating new things, ever destroying the old, marching one knows not very well whither, to a final self-destruction, say some, in an unending series of vain cycles, say others. In progressive cycles is the most optimistic conclusion, leading through whatever trouble and apparent confusion towards a higher and higher approximation to some divine apocalypse. And of course, progressive cycles, like a spiral that goes up and up and up. That's Giambattista Vico, the great Italian thinker. His book, New Science, Nuovo Scienza, lived from 1668 to 1744, and I commend him to your reading. He has this idea that history reveals, may I say it, the evolution of spirit, that we start small. We don't move linearly towards an improved state, but we go round and round. But every round takes us, lifts us a little bit higher. So a progressive cycle. Very different from Spengler, who sees us teetering on the brink. Ah, teeter we may, but beyond the brink we go. However that may be, this is certain, that there is not only no construction here without destruction, no harmony except by a poise of contending forces, one out of many actual and potential discords, but also no continued existence of life except by a constant self-feeding and devouring of other life. We'll get back to that in a moment, but you'll remember Sri Aurobindo, in the years before he began the Arya, often dealt with this idea of opposing forces in the world. Unity versus diversity, good versus evil, light versus dark, the clash of forces inherent at the base of things. And of course, that's Heraclitus. Things are always changing. You can't step twice into the same river. And all of creation is a mixture of forces, each vying for supremacy. So some things will be built up, some things will be taken away, and transience is the nature of the outer world. Is it the nature of the inner? This is what Arjuna has to weigh and consider as he moves beyond the shock of this episode in which he has to regard his kinsmen as people he will slay. Our very bodily life is a constant dying and being reborn. The body itself, a beleaguered city attacked by assailing, protected by defending forces, whose business is to devour each other. And this is only a type of all our existence. The command seems to have gone out from the beginning. Thou shalt not conquer except by battle with thy fellows and thy surroundings. Thou shalt not even live except by battle and struggle and by absorbing into thyself other life. The first law of this world that I have made is creation and preservation by destruction. He mocks us with his humor. Ancient thought accepted this starting point so far as you could see it by scrutiny of the universe. The old Upanishad saw it very clearly and phrased it with an uncompromising thoroughness, which will have nothing to do with any honeyed glosses or optimistic scuttlings of the truth. Hunger, that is death, they said, is the creator and master of this world. And they figured vital existence in the image of the horse of the sacrifice. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, hunger, that is death. 1, 2, 1. The horse of the sacrifice. People like to take that as figurative. No, the horse was really sacrificed. The significance of it, there was an inner dimension to it. We can take up another time. We won't dwell on the matter here. Speaking of matter. Matter, they described by a name which means ordinarily food, and they said, we call it food because it is devoured and devours creatures. That word, matter, annam. So if you remember when we looked at Sri Aurobindo's hierarchy of worlds, that matter seems to be the lowest, but it reflects the highest. The principle of Sat hides in the lowest, and that is Anam. Life, power, is prana. Mind is manas. The linking world to the higher worlds is the supramental. That's Vijnana, the great, the vast consciousness of truth, of knowledge. And then above, delight. Conscious power, the seat of real existence. But all that which is above is hidden here, is represented here. So when we see one thing devouring another, well, it's scarifying to the outer consciousness. But inwardly, we see simply the changing of forms. But how ought we to engage with the world consciously and not simply erratically, accidentally, adventitiously? Can we not do it willingly? Can we not experience all and offer all? And through that conscious exchange of energies, work in communion with the universal will, and through that exalt ourselves into oneness of being with he or she who truly wills. The eater eating is eaten. This is the formula of the material world, as the Darwinians rediscovered when they laid it down that the struggle for life is the law of evolutionary existence. And that is Taittiriya Upanishad 3.10.5. Modern science has only rephrased the old truths that had already been expressed in much more forcible, wide, and accurate formulas by the apothegm of Heraclitus and the figures employed by the Upanishads. Because quite largely, they used mythic language. Heraclitus was himself an initiate, clearly, and the Upanishads, all about the great, the secret doctrines. Nietzsche's insistence upon war as an aspect of life and the ideal man as a warrior, the camel man he may be to begin with and the child man hereafter, but the lion man he must become in the middle if he is to attain his perfection. These now much decried theories of Nietzsche have, however much we may differ from many of the moral and practical conclusions he drew from them, their undeniable justification, and recall us to a truth we like to hide out of sight. It is good that we should be reminded of it. First, because to see it has for every strong soul a tonic effect which saves us from the flabbiness and relaxation encouraged by a too mellifluous philosophic, religious, or ethical sentimentalism, that which loves to look upon nature as love and life and beauty and good, but turns away from her grim mask of death, adoring God as Shiva, but refusing to adore him as Rudra. Secondly, because unless we have the honesty and courage to look existence straight in the face, we shall never arrive at any effective solution of its discords and oppositions. How can we turn all things to honey if we can't comprehend them? Let's back up. Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, was a disciple of Heraclitus. Heraclitus, who says, war is the father of all things. You might also note here, just to play with the nuances, that Sri Aurobindo and his then colleague, Paul Richard, had a strong disagreement about what gives rise to the universe. For Richard, who was strongly influenced by European thinking, it was this conflict of will. He was much more interested in Nietzsche than he was in the philosophy of the Taittiriya Upanishad, which insists that it is bliss that gives birth to all, that all of this is an adventure of delight, and we are meant to find our ways back to it through, clearly, suffering, division, struggle. We've come from one. We've become many. Now can we climb back to the many? And again, the old image of Humpty Dumpty having fallen and broken to pieces, that's the mind. The mind has lost the sense of unity. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. because they're struggling to find the solution through life, through formalism, through the mind's capacity to understand. Reunification, reunion, communion, identity are our future. By the way, Shiva, take it to its root, it means pure white, auspicious. Rudra, from the Veda, the howler. It's the same divine being. You think Shiva, sitting in meditation in the Himalayas, in his snowy vastness, absorbed the infinite, exploring the infinite. But provoke him, and one radiant glance of Shiva brings much destruction. Rudra steps forth to denounce and dissolve untoward creations so that a greater creation can come. Destruction is necessary for a greater creation to arise. We must see first what life and the world are. Afterwards, we can all the better set about finding the right way to transform them into what they should be. So Arjuna, again, has first to confront it. So Krishna has led him to this point. Krishna is in charge of everything that's happening on that battlefield. He may be an important player. He's not the lead figure, but he's the wise counselor behind and the Purushottama above, directing everything. He has brought Arjuna, the greatest fighter of his age, the man who represents the future of India, to this point where he has to see the conflict of ethics. There is no path forward if you expect ethics to deliver for you the one true source of your action. To find that, you have to go within, and then you have to go above. If this repellent aspect of existence holds in itself some secret of the final harmony, we shall, by ignoring or belittling it, miss that secret, and all our efforts at a solution will fail by fault of our self-indulgent ignoring of the true elements of the problem. If, on the other hand, it is an enemy to be beaten down, trampled on, excised, eliminated, still we gain nothing by underrating its power and hold upon life, or refusing to see how firmly it is rooted in the effective past and the actually operative principles of existence. So this will lead us to a deeper examination of the three gunas, the nature of Prakriti, and what we seem to be in this divided triple world. Sattva, Rajas, Tamas. We'll come to it all, but the scene is being set. We'll put a bookmark here and complete the chapter next time we meet. And here's the section from Savitri, which I think is apposite of what we've been working on tonight. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we'll begin at the bottom of page 32. The war of thoughts that fathers the universe. The clash of forces struggling to prevail in the tremendous shock that lights a star. As in the building of a grain of dust, the grooves that turn their dumb ellipse in space, plowed by the seeking of the world's desire, the long regurgitations of time's flood, the torment edging the dire force of lust that wakes kinetic in Earth's dullard slime and carves a personality out of mud. The sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed, the estrus which creates with fire of pain, the fate that punishes virtue with defeat, the tragedy that destroys long happiness, the weeping of love, the quarrel of the gods, seized in a truth which lives in its own light. His soul stood free, a witness and a king. Absorbed no more in the moment-ridden flux, where mind incessantly drifts as on a raft, hurried from phenomenon to phenomenon, he abode at rest in indivisible time. As if a story long written but acted now, in his present he held his future and his past, felt in the seconds the uncounted years, and saw the hours like dots upon a page. An aspect of the unknown reality altered the meaning of the cosmic scene. This huge material universe became a small result of a stupendous force. Overtaking the moment, the eternal ray illumined that which never yet was made. Thought lay down in a mighty voicelessness. The toiling thinker widened and grew still. Wisdom transcendent touched his quivering heart. His soul could sail beyond thought's luminous bar. Mind screened no more the shoreless infinite. Across a void retreating sky, he glimpsed through a last glimmer and drift of vanishing stars, the superconscient realms of motionless peace, where judgment ceases and the word is mute, and the unconceived lies pathless and alone. There came not form or any mounting voice. There only were silence and the absolute. Out of that stillness, mind newborn arose and woke to truths once inexpressible. And forms appeared, dumbly significant, a seeing thought, a self-revealing voice. He knew the source from which his spirit came. Movement was married to the immobile vast. He plunged his roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity. Namaste. Jai Ma.